Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2003, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a cricket commentator. He should have been playing it rather than writing and talking about it, but an accident at the age of 17 stopped all that. His family found him a good job in the city, but it bored him rigid, and he turned to sports reporting. He's been a regular contributor to Test Match Special on Radio 3 for more than 30 years. He's written for most newspapers about the game and published more than a dozen books on the subject. In all that time, he's been an itinerant freelance, lord of all he surveys, a unique mixture of the well-connected and the sort of one-off that goes naturally with cricket. When I think about it, he says, much of my life has been as close to the Bertie Wooster experience as I can get. He is Henry Blofeldt, commonly known as Blowers. The Wooster experience, one would define then, Henry, as what? Sort of lurching about from crisis to crisis?
Oh, absolutely, and finding crises where they don't exist, too.
But enjoying it all hugely.
Oh, I think so, because I've always believed you've got to live in the present. There's no point in looking at the past, you can do nothing about it. And you can't do much about the future either. At least I've never been able to do much about the future. But, you know, one way or another, I think I've been jolly lucky. But I have had one or two crises. I mean, I busted under a bus, as you said, when I was 17, and I had a sort of heart thing a few years ago where I died 8 times one morning or something. And one got it.
And the last rites read to you.
Oh, and by my brother-in-law, who got rather frisky with the oil, and I almost drowned me in it, I think.
But what all of that means is that cricket has been a kind of natural fit for you, as I was trying to say in that introduction, really, that it's a sort of gentlemanly game. It's something that requires decorum and all those things. It just suited you down to the ground, didn't it?
Well, I was passionate about cricket, I suppose, at about the age of 7 or 8. And at my private school at Sunningdale in Berkshire, and Miss Paterson, who was to bowl underarm, I remember she probably taught me the start of my interest in cricket. I watched a test match at Lord's in 1948 and saw Don Bradman play cricket. And it got into me, and I was then lucky and found I could play it quite well. And I played it very seriously, and I mean, I jolly well was going to try and get as far as I could. Then I had this silly accident, and I played a bit of cricket after that, but I wasn't very good.
I want to ask you about the silly accident, but just tell me about what you bring to the wireless comment. I use the wireless advisedly because, I mean, I think that's how you must feel. It's not a radio, is it?
Oh, good Lord, no. We can't have awful things like that.
So on the wireless, what you bring to it is this detail. I mean, they say you're obsessed with passing buses and butterflies and birds and...
Well, I know, this is the awful thing. It's rather sort of stuck on me, that. When I did my first trial for BBC, this was about 1968, I remember coming to Broadcasting House, where we are now, and talking to Henry Riddle, who was then the assistant head of Outside Broadcast, sound. And we sat in his office. He rather wrong-footed me, because I arrived at 4:30 in the afternoon, and he's wearing a black tie. And I thought, oh, Lord, I'm rather underdressed. Anyhow, I sat there, and we listened to the tapes, and I've always loathed listening to myself. I always think, what a pompous idiot I sound like. I really do. And if ever I hit in a car and hear a recording of myself, I switch the programmes at once. But he did say, you've got to try and make the listeners feel they're there. You've got to try and paint the picture for them. And he said, when I say the picture, he pointed at a picture on the wall and he said, the centre of that are the horses, which you would look at. But it wouldn't be a complete composite picture if it wasn't for the grass at their feet and for the trees at their side, the sky above, and then, of course, the mount and the frame. And that is my excuse for mentioning buses and everything else, and I stick to it. And most of a lot of our listeners ring in when it's a bad light or rain and there's no cricket. They ring in and say how much better we are when there's nothing happening.
OK, let's have your first piece of music for this desert island. What's it to be?
Well, it's the Eton boating song. I was 5 years at Eton. They were probably, in some ways, the happiest of my life. Power without responsibility. I absolutely adored it, and I feel I could almost go back there tomorrow. And I do go back quite often down there, and I think it's a wonderful tune. And it's sitting on my desert island. It would remind me of so many things and so many people.
Yeah.
the Eton College Musical Society and Orchestra performing the Eton boating song, or part of it anyway. Memories for you, Henry Blofeld, of School of Eton, where your prowess was cricket, much, much more than your academic prowess.
Well, I started off in sort of Lower Sixpenny and for 2 years.
Lower Sixpenny.
Lower Sixpenny was the name of the under-15 sort of side, the school under-15 side, rather a romantic name, I always think.
Sweet.
Presided over by a splendid chap called Claude Taylor, who taught me more about cricket than anyone else. And I went straight, as it so happened, from Lower Sixpenny into the 11. I played for the 11 when I was 15.
The first 11.
First 11.
You played at Lords,
yeah,
I think, didn't
I
you?
I did play at Lords when I was 15, yes. When I was third victim of a hat-trick in my first appearance at Lords.
Against whom?
Harrow.
I see.
Oh, the Eton Harrow match.
And you scored a century at Lords at some point as well, when you were 17?
I scored 100 at Lords. I scored 200 at Lords, in fact, just to show off. When I was 16, I was selected, very luckily, for the public schools against combined services, and went in when I'm going to really stretch my luck here, when the score was 71 for 6, and I finished, I think, 104 not out, against mostly first-class cricketers. And so this got me a little bit of perhaps a spurious reputation, I don't know. But what it didn't take into account was my lack of navigational ability. And the following year, you see, I had this accident.
Well, I want to hear about the accident. You keep advertising it to us, as it were. 1957, you were 17 years old. You were captain by then of the Eton First 11.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, it was, I mean, I don't really know what happened. I've only been told, because I can't remember anything, but it was after boys' dinner one day, which was what we called something that wasn't really a feast, but when we all had chewed the cud at midday. And I bicycled up. I was one of the boys allowed a bicycle because I was Captain 11, and we went up to Nets on Agar's Plough. Talking over my shoulder to a friend of mine, Edward Scott.
But talking backwards?
Looking backwards. And I wasn't. And then I went straight over the road and into a bus that was coming rather fast from right to left from the village of Datchet, carrying a group, I've always been told, of French Women's Institute ladies. And they all jumped out and said, "Zut alors." And there was I, sort of, as a rather bleeding jam roll in the gutter. And I got carted off to one of those hospitals in Windsor, where I stayed for quite a long time, and I didn't really sort of come to.
But how badly injured were you?
Oh, I think I was pretty badly injured. I believe my skull was cracked all the way around, except for an inch at the back. I mean, I was really quite lucky to. It was nastily cracked.
And what about your limbs?
My limbs, well, such as they were not too badly off. But I had to have quite a number of brain operations, I suppose, to remove flakes of bone out of my grey matter. Also, eventually, I had to have a lot of plastic surgery done, too, or quite a lot of plastic surgery.
Mm. Mm. So it's pretty devastating.
It was, yes, and of course, what I really suffered from, I mean, I got back quite quickly when you think about it. I mean, I was playing cricket before the end of the season, playing minor county cricket, too, for Norfolk, which I shouldn't have done because my reflexes had gone. I mean, I couldn't signal from eye to feet. Mm. I couldn't move my legs. And I never played cricket as well again.
So it robbed you of your instinctive ability to play.
I mean, I was lucky and went on and played for Cambridge as the worst opening batsman since the Crimean War, I think, probably, and made very little contribution against the old enemy of Oxford when I scored 2 and 1. But I did manage to slog 100 against the MCC at Lords, so that does count as a first-class 100. So that rather pleased me.
It was rather miraculous.
Well, I know. But I think probably it was. I think the Almighty was looking the other way or something when I had this accident. I mean, I was lucky, obviously, to live. But, Sue, where I was really lucky was not to end up as a cabbage. You know, I mean, there are some people, of course, who say that perhaps I have, but there we are.
Record number two.
Record number two. Gilbert and Sullivan, I've loved all my life. I was taken to see the first one I ever saw, The Pirates of Penzance, by my mother and father at the Theatre Royal in Norwich when I was still at Sunningdale. And this, I love the patter songs from Gilbert and Sullivan. And this is If You're Anxious for to Shine from Patience, which I think is my favourite of all the Gilbert and Sullivan operas.
If you're anxious for to shine in the high aesthetic line as a man of culture rare, you must get up all the germs of the transcendental terms and plant them everywhere. You must lie upon the daisies and discourse in novel phrases of your complicated state of mind. The meaning doesn't matter if it's only idle chatter of a transcendental kind. And everyone will say, as you walk your mystic way, if this young man expresses himself in terms too deep for me, why, what a very singularly deep young man this deep young man must be. Be eloquent in praise of the very dull old days which have long since passed away. And convince him, if you can, that the reign of good Queen Anne was culture's palmiest day. Of course you will...
If you're anxious for to shine, from Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience or Bunthorne's Bride, that was sung by John Reed as Reginald Bunthorne with the New Symphony Orchestra of London. It was conducted by Isidore Godfrey, a Doyley Cart opera production. Memories of your childhood then, Henry Blofeld, going to see such productions. Your father liked them, he read stories to you, it all sounds quite jolly, but apparently you were rather frightened of him. He was a bit of a stickler.
My father was a formidable chap. He stood 6'6" tall in his cotton, his stocking feet. He had a moustache, a small moustache. He wore an eyeglass, which is a little bit intimidating. He used to put it in and just drop it out, you know, to relax the muscles. I think I was frightened of him, certainly. And I think it was the age, you see. When I was young and had all my meals in the nursery with Nanny, and I was made to look respectable at about sort of 5:30 in the evening and went into the drawing room for an hour or 45 minutes. And my papa did one thing he did for me. He read to me. He had a wonderful voice. I know hunting's not exactly the thing these days, but he read to me Mr. Jorrocks, Handley Cross, and it's a huge book, and I loved it. Of course, he read Winnie the Pooh and all those A. Milne things, which I again absolutely loved.
But it was obviously Nanny who was really the special person.
Nanny was absolutely special on all the tantrums. Nanny actually, also, I taught Nanny to bowl underarm at me too on the croquet lawn, and that didn't go down very well, for he took all the croquet hoops out, which she did, and I used to slog her into the bramble bushes, and poor Nanny used to go, and I'd run about 23 for a single hit while she was trying to find the greed ball.
What about your mother? Because you were the youngest of three, and actually much the youngest. You were sort of half. Were you a mistake?
I was, absolutely. No, it was a mistake. Good heavens, yes.
But I read a very sweet story that she prepared you for going away to school, to your prep school at Sunningdale, age 7, by calling you by your surname.
Yes, she said, you must get used to this. She was tough. My mother took no prisoners at all. She was very tough and absolutely uncompromising. She said, now, for the next fortnight, she said, I'm going to call you what you're called at, you'll be called at Sunningdale, you'll be called Blofeld. So I was, Blofeld, for someone. There was the lovely story of my mother, too, once, which is not about me, but about my brother. My brother, John, at some stage, you wouldn't think high court judges got up to things like this, but he used to bite people occasionally. And my mother told Nanny and said, look, if John bites again, will you thrust him out into the passage outside the nursery door, and I shall hear screams and yells, and I shall come out and bite him. So the next time, they suddenly heard a slam of the nursery door, and my brother making a lot of noise in the passage. So my mother bared her teeth and went running out in the passage and dug her teeth deep into him, and of course Nanny had completely forgotten and ejected him for something entirely different and much, much less serious.
Record number three,
Noel Coward, who's always been a tremendous favourite of mine. I first heard Noel Coward on record when I was very young. I think, again, my father probably enjoyed him very much. I love the stately homes of England. I think on my desert island it'll remind me of so much, not least when I met the great man Noel Coward with Ian Fleming in Jamaica.
Lord Elderly, Lord Boromir, Lord Sicket, and Lord Kemp. With every virtue, every grace, our water veils the sceptred race. Here you see the four of us, and there are so many more of us eldest sons that must succeed. We know how Caesar conquered Gaul and how to whack a cricket ball. Apart from this, our education lacks coordination, though we're young.
Part of the Stately Homes of England, sung by Noel Coward with His Majesty's Theatre Orchestra, conducted by Francis Collinson, and that was recorded in 1938. And you met him, Noel Coward, on honeymoon, well, your honeymoon, I don't think he went on one, in Jamaica in 1961, yes.
If it was his honeymoon, he wasn't admitting anything.
But he was apparently incredibly modest.
Oh, he was incredibly modest. He never stopped talking. And I remember we went to Goldeneye, Ian Fleming's house at Oracabessa with the Banana Port, where there, that lovely song, Belafonte's, was produced originally. And we went there, and there were a number of people there, and Noel Coward was in effervescent form. Deboy, he said, I'm so enchanted to have met you and your beautiful lady bride. He said, you must do me the great privilege and honour of coming down the road to my little house at Port Maria. And he said, where are you staying? And I said, the Jamaica Inn. And he said, don't worry. He said, I'll ring you. He said, you've got better things to do than ring dirty old men like me on your honeymoon. When the telephone went the next day, must have been, I was 9:10, I said hello, and a voice said, can I speak to Henry Blofeld? And I said, speaking. He said, this is Noel Coward. He said, I don't know if you remember, we met at lunch at Ian Fleming's place yesterday, which I thought, as throwaway lines go, was just about the best.
But the Ian Fleming connection is interesting because, of course, the name Blofeld is one that we all know from his books. Ernst Stavro Blofeld, his real villain. Is that connected with you?
Oh, he's part of the castle we don't normally show to visitors. Yes, Ian and my father were at school together at Eton. I don't know that they particularly got on very well. I'm not sure. Anyway, the story is that when Ian was writing Thunderball and he wanted an evil name, he was obviously in Chapter 2 or Chapter 3, he got into a taxi and went to Boodle's, which his club, and he opened the membership list, which was at hand. And when he got to the B's and saw three Blofelds, my brother, my father and myself, he didn't look any further. And
he thought it sounded suitably spooky, didn't he?
I think he jumped up, pressed the bell, ordered a glass of champagne, did a buck and wing dance, and then went home and never looked back. And as you say, Ernst Stavro Blofeld is the chap who's always seen on the screen stroking the white pussy.
Now, how soon did it become obvious, going back to your boyhood, that you weren't really a chip off the old block in the sense that I think the family tradition was Eton followed by King's Cambridge and a double first, and you weren't going to do that? You went to both, but you weren't going to get near the double first, were you?
Well, it took me 2 years to teach them the folly of their ways before I got really shown the door. But I had a great piece of luck in that although I was nothing like the cricketer I had been, I was good enough or bad enough to scrape into a side, the Cambridge side in 1959 and get a blue, which was very lucky. And it gave me a little bit of experience of first-class cricket. So I suppose, looking back on my life, you could say that I got the only degree that I needed, ironically.
But at the time, it wouldn't have felt like that. And I'm sure your family were in deep despair about it.
Oh, absolute despair.
Yes. Did you feel inferior, Henry?
I did. I think I had an enormous inferiority complex.
And you had?
And I think I behaved rather wetly, too.
Do you? Why? Yes.
Well, I think I didn't really come to terms with it. And I sort of thought life would go on, you know, in the same way that it had. I don't think I ever really, at that stage of my life, rationalised my actions.
So you had to get a job. There was Henry. No qualifications, no degree, nothing, and not as good at cricket as he used to be. What did you do?
Well, it wasn't really what I did. I had a splendid uncle, a man called Mark Turner, who was then one of the principal directors of Robert Benson Lonsdale Merchant Bank in the city. And I went there and started in 1959, in October 59, as a trainee. And I absolutely loathed it. I mean, it was amazing. I had a waistcoat, a bowler hat, a rolled umbrella. I looked a real turkey, I can promise you. And I think I bought the Financial Times too, probably. In the end, I thought, well, you know, a lot of my friends write about cricket. Why shouldn't I? And I met at a party Johnny Woodcock, who was the famous Times cricket correspondent, and I talked to him about it, and he said, well, if he could do anything, he would, but he didn't have any great high hopes. And I got back from the city about 2 days later, or maybe even the next day, to find someone at the Times was ill or broken a leg or something like that, and they wanted someone to go and do 2 days cricket at Gravesend for the next 2 days. And if I wanted to, and yippee I did, would I go round to the Times Sports Centre and collect a press ticket, which I did.
You wanted to, yes. And the rest is history. Record number four.
Record number four is Thank Heaven for Little Girls, and it very much reminds me of the excitement of the 60s and also of the fact that I saw Maurice Chevalier in person at his last performance in England at the time of the twist, and the old boy of 80-something was twisting better than anyone.
Thank heaven for little girls. Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do? Thank heaven. Thank heaven. Thank heaven for little girls.
Thank Heaven for Little Girls from the film Gigi, sung by Maurice Chevalier, with the MGM Studio Orchestra conducted by André Previn. So, Henry, you spent the 60s writing for various newspapers, and then you got your feet under the table, really, at Test Match Special in the early 70s. But commentating, I mean, it is a very specific skill. It's a fine line, isn't it, between talking enough but not talking too much?
Yes, I dare say there are those who would say I've never learnt the value of the pause.
Well, but, difficult on the radio.
Well, it is difficult, but some people did. I mean, John Arlott was masterful at his timing, which involved the pause. I think I'd rather go at it like a bull in a china shop. But I suppose I can get away with it, so I go very quick, I talk very quickly. Mm. But I think because I probably enunciate reasonably clearly, which enables one, I think, probably to go helter-skelter.
Exactly, but you do need nerve to keep going and to fill all these gaps. And, I mean, that was often fuelled by booze, was it not, in John Arlott's time? I mean, a lot of alcohol was taken.
Well, dear old Arlo, I mean, he was a legend in
his
own lunchtime.
He's Arlo, as in John as an Agus.
Yes, Arlo. Okay. He was a legend in his own lunchtime, I think one has to say. And a good deal of booze did flow under the bridge, but I think we kept it generally in proportion to the box. Trevor Bailey, we always got fed on champagne by our listeners.
Champagne before lunch.
Yes, and Trevor always would say, the medicine has arrived when a cork was taken out. But there was the lovely occasion once after an evening when we had dinner in Broadcasting House with the Director General. It was rather heavy going the next day, and I helped Arlo up the stairs, up to the top of the house, so to speak, when we were gloriously in the pavilion and not when we were in that new thing over the other side of the ground. And I took his two big leather briefcases. I thought, picked up the first one. I thought, well, learned wisdoms, learned terms about cricket, more so with the second, which is even heavier. And we got to the top of the stairs, three flights of stairs, into the box. And they were there. Brian Jonas was there in his brown and white correspondent's shoes, giggling away. And I put them down on the green base table. And Arlott waited and then advanced upon the table, smiling the sort of smile, I dare say, the Duke of Wellington smiled when he left Waterloo for the last time. He opened the first briefcase and took out six bottles of claret, opened the second one, took out five bottles of claret, a couple of glasses and sundry bits and pieces and two corkscrews. And he was always a belt and braces man. One of his earliest pieces of advice to me, Henry, he said, when you go to the cricket, he said, and you take a bottle or two of wine, always take two corkscrews, because he said, if you take one and it breaks, you're buggered. And there he was with 11 bottles of claret, and he faced the audience. We were there like goldfish with our mouths open, gaping at him. And he said, well, he said, with any good fortune, he said, that little lot should see us through until the lunch interval. In point of fact, they were meant for another destination. I think we may have got one.
Don't spoil the story. No. I'm sure a lot of claret was taken, but there we are. Record number five. Tell me about that.
Record number five is Brian Johnston and John Arlott, really, not together. John Arlott heralded the first ever streaker at Lord's, which was in the Test match in 1975. As you will hear in a moment, the freaker. But first of all, I would love to listen to, and on a desert island, these bring back so many memories, to the famous giggle, Jonas and Agus at the Oval in 1991. When Botham was out, he tried to get his leg over the wicket and knocked off a bail.
He just didn't quite get his leg over.
Anyhow, he did very well indeed, batting 131 minutes and hit three fours. And then we had Lewis playing extremely well for his 47 not out. Agus, do stop it. He was joined by De Freitas, who was in for 40 minutes, a useful little partnership there. They put on 35 in 40 minutes, and then he was caught by Dujon Walsh. Lawrence, always entertaining, batted for 35 minutes, hit a four over the wicketkeepers.
And a freaker.
A freaker.
We've got a freaker down the wicket now, not very shapely, and it's masculine. And I would think it's seen the last of its cricket for the day. The police are mustered, so are the cameramen, and Greg Chappell. And now he's had his load, he's being embraced by a blonde policeman. 8,000 people in the man stand, some of whom perhaps have never seen anything quite like this before.
That was John Arlott commentating on the first ever streaker at Lord's, or freaker, as he put it, in 1975. And before that, of course, Brian Johnson and Jonathan Agnew rendered speechless during a test match in 1991. You've been, Henry, at the sharp end of so many big cricketing stories over the decades, but none bigger, I suspect, than when Kerry Packer invented his World Series cricket back in 1977. He brought up all the best players in the world, didn't he? And,
yes, he did, all because of a battle over television rights in Australia, which the Australian board weren't prepared to give to him, although he was prepared to pay a great deal more money than the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
So he bought up all these players, and some of the, he bankrolled matches, didn't he? Put them on his own Channel 9. But did it rob, I think the fear was that it would rob the sport of its decorum, really, that sportsmanship would go by the board, that it would cease to be amateurish, really, as it became more professional in terms of its commercialism. Did that happen?
Well, yes, it did, and I think it would have happened anyway, Sue, because as more money comes into a game, habits tend to become rather more unpleasant.
Well, and chaps don't behave so well.
Yeah, and I think this has happened in cricket. Certainly it's happened, as the money is, you know, winner takes all. I mean, it's all based on that, isn't it?
And is that part of our problem today? I mean, as we know, the perception is, despite certain successes earlier this year, I think people, the view is that England is not as good as it was. It is being surpassed all of the time by Australia. We just don't do it like we used to.
I'm not quite certain if it's that. It may be the other way around. When we used to win fairly consistently, England was the only country who played it professionally. Now everyone plays it professionally and has left England far behind. We have not adapted our game at all. They have adapted theirs. We still go on playing, having 18 first-class counties with a fair number of fairly indifferent cricketers. The competition may be good, but I don't think the class of county cricket necessarily is quite the same as it is in the Sheffield Shield in Australia. They only have six sides there. They play much less first-class cricket. But each game is gone into as though it's a mini test match. Mm. Whereas in England, if you're out one innings for naught, you don't worry too much because you've got another one the next day.
But in terms of the tradition, the English tradition, I mean, little boys no longer are round the back of the entry, you know, bowling balls at the brick wall. I mean, they just don't do that anymore. Football has taken over. Cricket just isn't central to a young boy's life as it used to be.
Well, I think this is true, and I think the trouble is we haven't got a national side that wins. Once we get a national side that beats Australia, I think an awful lot of more people will want to be whoever the cricketers are rather than Becks and Posh and all the others.
It's chicken and egg, though, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. But I know efforts are going on to try and regenerate it a little bit in the public sector, and I hope very much this happens.
OK. One quick anorak question. Of all the cricketers you've ever seen perform before your very eyes, which one would you point to as being the most inspiring?
I think I'd have to point to Gary Sobers.
I thought you might say Botham, actually.
Botham was tremendously exciting, but not in quite the same league as Gary Sobers.
And what's more, he once duffed you up, so you wouldn't choose
Well,
him.
No. But Beefy and I now are the greatest of friends. I mean, we were all too much younger in those days. And, you know, we got it rather wrong that morning at Bermuda Airport, I remember.
Beefy and Blowers were at it. OK, record number six.
Record number six, High Society, is the film that I think I've seen more than any other. And the song from it, which I absolutely love, is Well Did You Ever, when both Bing and Frank were very well oiled. And it's glorious.
Don't dig that kind of crooning, chum. Have you heard it's in the stars? Next July we collide with Mars. Well, did you ever? What a swell party, a swell party, a swell elegant, elegant party this is.
Well, did you ever, from the film High Society, sung by Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra with the MGM Studio Orchestra conducted by Johnny Green. There's obviously a lot of sheer bloody-mindedness in you, Henry. I mean, when we talk about you recovering from that early accident and recovering from your heart problem earlier this year, I mean, there's a determination, isn't there, in you, a kind of, you know exactly what you want to do and where you want to go.
Well, I suppose I don't much care for coming second, in a way. And it seems to me that if you do anything, it's worth doing well, isn't it?
I think.
You may say I have too strong a competitive streak, and that certainly, I mean, when I play games, even if I play tennis now, I think I probably want to win. Some say would say it too obviously, but that's part of my nature.
But we don't hear that when you're commentating. We don't hear, I mean, I know because I've read that you've said about yourself that you have a bad temper, you inherited it from your father. We don't hear that. What we hear on the radio is sort of bonhomie and repartee and that sort of eccentricity. How much is that you and how much is that your professional persona?
I don't think any of it's professional persona. I've never really consciously said anything or developed a manner or anything of that sort. It has just simply been me. And unless one gets desperate feedback saying this is simply awful and we just have him off the air in a moment, I mean, which I haven't had, touch wood, I just bang on, you know.
But Jonas is gone now, as we know, sadly, and you're sort of still holding the fort of that sort of prep school master going to the match, aren't you? One gets the impression that very slightly some of the ones who sit alongside you these days send you up a bit, cast you as
they always pull my leg all the time. I mean, they're forever doing things. I mean, Jonathan Agnew pulls my leg endlessly. I mean, he writes out bogus emails and signed by names, which said quickly can sort of look like something rather naughty that one shouldn't say on the air. And the awful thing is, though, I don't even realise when I've said it that I've said something I shouldn't have said.
But I wonder if you do feel that the character is going out of that sort of commentary slowly but surely. I mean, you're still there, obviously, and I know you've got no intention of going away, but eventually you will, inevitably.
Of course.
I mean, do you think that everything's getting rather sort of... Well, made more bland than it was, both the game and those who commentate on it.
I think the present team do it jolly well. I think one of the great characteristics of Test Match Special has always been that it's had great people on air, great characters, and people with strongly distinctive voices. And I'd like to think that is going to be continued, but I'm not certain. I mean, I think Cricket the Game is a great former of people's character, and I think actually Cricket the Game is a reflection of society.
And the game has fewer characters in it, doesn't it?
I think it does. I don't think cricketers today play it with such fun. They play it with tremendous zest because they want to win, and the rewards for winning are very much greater than they were. I'll tell you what's a very interesting story. Keith Miller, who I had lunch with the other day, and it was the famous Australian cricketer. You're looking a bit blank, but, and he was a great all-rounder.
You found me out.
And he was sort of Dennis Compton, that sort of time. And Keith was saying he really couldn't understand this business of pressure. All the players complain today that they're under pressure. He said, I'll tell you what pressure was, he said. When I was in a hurricane, he said, and I looked in my rearview mirror and saw two Messerschmitts on my tail, he said, that was pressure. And he said, when we were playing the cricket after the war, he said, it wasn't a matter of life and death. We'd been through that. He said, we played it hard on the field, but not off it. And he said, we got together, and he said, it was always a game, and we knew it was. And today, I sometimes wonder if everyone knows all the time that it is still a game.
Record number 7.
Dad's Army, theme tune. Who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Hitler? This kills two birds with one stone. I love Dad's Army. And, of course, sung by Bud Flanagan. And I was very much brought up on the Crazy Gang at the Victoria Palace with Flanagan and Alan, Nerva and Knox and all the others. And it was terrific.
Kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run. We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think you are, kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done?
Dad's Army theme tune, Who Do You Think You're Kidding, Mr. Hitler, sung by Bud Flanagan. There's going to be a lot of laughter on your island, Henry.
That's what I want to do, because I love laughing, and I think it's terribly important. I think we all feel better when we laugh.
But do you think the kind of solitariness of the existence there is going to make any sort of prick the bubble of optimism that surrounds you?
I shall do my very best to see that it doesn't. I'm wildly hopeless at all the sort of DIY things. I'm frightfully impractical. I'm desperately absent-minded. And if I was able to somehow invent a fish hook in order to catch a fish, the only thing I'd end up by catching would be myself.
But you can hunt. I mean, you can skin a rabbit, can't you? Taught that.
Oh, I can do that. Absolutely, yes.
All right. So your body and soul in that sense are catered for. It's really the lack of claret that's
well,
problem.
Well, no. I didn't think you would have the temerity to send me to a desert island that didn't have a fairly well-stocked cellar.
Last record.
My last record, Victor Borger, who I think was tremendous fun, the Dane, who had this way with words and this way with punctuation.
A period sounds like this. Here is a dash. An exclamation point is a vertical dash with a period underneath. I have a book here, and I'm going to read to you a short story so you can hear how this system really sounds. Beautiful Eleanor sat alone, dreaming of but one thing. They had been sitting in the park, and Henry had said, "Darling."
Part of Victor Borger's phonetic punctuation. Now, Henry, what you have to do is say which one you'd take if you could only take one of those eight.
If I could only take one, I would take Brian Johnston, Jonathan Agnew and John Arlott, simply because Test Match Special has been the top, bottom and sides of my life. I enjoy cricket. I enjoy more than anything the people I do Test Match Special with. They're absolutely super friends, all of them. And this would be a terrific reminder of all that.
What about your book, as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
My book would have to be Woodhouse. I love Woodhouse, and I once had an almost complete collection of his first editions. The one I would take, actually, is A Pelican at Blandings, which is, I think the Blandings Castle saga is more fun than Jeeves. This is my own personal thing.
We could discuss this at length, but we shan't. What about your luxury?
My luxury, I don't know if I'm allowed this, but what I want to do is take a photograph album, and I want to take 40 or 50 mugshots of all people who've been close to me in my life. In terms of cricket, I'm obviously Bitten and Suki, my daughter, and Rumpel, who's my handicapped stepson, who was a very important member of our family and absolutely splendid. And I would want to take them, my parents and family, people from the commentary box, so I could flick through the pages, and each one, each photograph would bring tremendous memories of people I've loved. Nice, but I might have one or two I've hated, but I don't think so. No. We leave them behind.
Henry Blofeld, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.